Ukraine began restricting power use on Thursday after several attacks by Russian forces on its electrical infrastructure.
It is a very targeted outage, so it's not a blackout. It's different. There is no electricity, but for instance, emergency institutions like hospitals, they are still having electricity.
Plus, despite denials from both Moscow and Tehran, what role do Iranian-made drones play in Russia's war in Ukraine?
They're being used very purposely as a way to generate psychological terror effects with strikes on residential infrastructure, civilian infrastructure, etc.
And later in the program, the role cryptocurrency plays in helping the war effort. Today is Thursday, October 20th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Steve Miller. On Wednesday, in an interview with Canadian broadcaster CTV, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky accused Tehran of supplying Russia with drones in its war of aggression against his country. Here he is, heard through an interpreter.
I do not trust the leadership of Iran, and by the way, tragic situations besides friendship between Canada, also tragedies connect us. Personally, do not trust those Iranian words. They publicly denied all that, saying that we didn't sell anything. But here we see hundreds of strikes at Ukraine, at the capital, at civil infrastructure, at schools, nearby the university, at the university, and the shutting down of our energy system for the people not to get through the winter, killing people either with hunger that happened blocking of the sea routes, or with cold, with freeze, what they do right now. Iran supplies them drones, supplies them kills of Ukrainians. This is what they agreed on for money, this bloody money that Iran is earning.
Moscow denied using Iranian-made drones at the United Nations on Wednesday. Russian Deputy Ambassador to the UN, Dmitry Polansky, says that the drones are manufactured in Russia.
And I would recommend that you do not underestimate technological capabilities of the Russian drone industry. I can tell you, we know what we do and we know how to do it.
Saeed Erivani, the permanent representative of the Islamic Republic of Iran to the UN, says that the allegations against his country are political.
It is recently disappointing that to pursue their political agenda, these states are trying to launch a disinformation campaign against Iran.
Ukraine is restricting power use on Thursday in response to Russian attacks that damaged parts of the country's electrical infrastructure. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky urged people to conserve energy in an address late on Wednesday. Anna Chernikova joins us from Kyiv with a power return shortly ago. What can you share with us about the experience of being partially without power on this Thursday?
Hi, Steve. Today is the first day that Ukraine has this scheduled power outages across the country. Basically, how it works that we have this, so every city has its own schedule. Normally, it's a four-hour outage, which means that there is no power supply to the apartment buildings, to the houses, and there is no electricity or like street lightning and this kind of stuff. However, it is a very targeted outage, so it's not a blackout. It's different. There is no electricity, but for instance, emergency institutions like hospitals, they are still having electricity, or emergency stuff like elevators or water pumping stations, they are also working. So while it is no electricity, Ukrainians still have water. This is done in order to help energy system to recover and to stabilize after this recent attacks that happened in this past couple of weeks. Some other regions, situation varies. So some regions that suffered more with attacks where the infrastructure was damaged more, they have longer outages and also water supply issues. But still, in general, government announced this scheduled power outages in order to stabilize the system in whole. So, for instance, when Kyiv citizens don't have electricity, this means that other regions of Ukraine and outskirts of Kyiv can have more stable electricity supply. And this is basically how it's going to work for this next weeks. We don't have exact information for the moment for how long will it take, but at least for now, we have this schedule for the next week.
Anna, when I was living in Arizona and even in California as well, during the summer months, it gets incredibly hot there. And there's an incredible draw upon the energy systems there because of people drawing power to fuel their air conditioners to combat the heat. And there were times where there were what we call rolling blackouts, periods of lower power, even brownouts where partial power goes away. But they were completely unexpected. You're saying that there is a schedule, that residents are informed, so they can kind of plan their days as to when power in their area is going to be out. How is that information communicated to people in Ukraine and specifically in Kyiv, since that's where you are?
So in Ukraine, a lot of information is provided through Telegram channels or online channels, which are used for communication with the society. So it's the Ministry of Energy and also this supply companies, which is responsible for power supply. So for instance, in Kyiv citizens have a chance to go online on the website of the power supply company and just type in the name of the street, the number of the building, and basically the schedule would be provided using this information. Also, there is a possibility for Kyiv region, for example. Also, there is a possibility to go online, and there is a website where you have everything like a table with regions, and you just look at the region, you find your the name of your either neighborhood or your settlement where you're living or a village, and you just check which group you are in. So for instance, for the moment, what I can see from this table is that there are two groups in the Kyiv region, and one group, for instance, has electricity outage in the morning, then another group would have in the afternoon and the other way around. And it changes every day. So basically, people just either go online or they can have this information from the communication channels, either on Telegram or, again, the websites of the power supply companies or chatbots. It's also very popular in Ukraine that there is this chatbots that also work quite effectively.
Anna Chernikova in Kyiv, thank you very much for that fascinating update. Now, despite the recent denials from both Moscow and Tehran about Russia using Iranian-made drones in Ukraine, U.S. National Security Council spokesperson John Kirby told VOA's Persian service that was not the truth.
We knew that these drones were going to be introduced onto the battlefield when we said publicly that the Russians were going to Tehran to buy them.
So what's the significance of Russia relying on these drones rather than other sophisticated weapons? Carolina Hurd is a Russia researcher at the Institute for the Study of War. Carolina, welcome to Flashpoint Ukraine. So I guess where I want to begin is over the past week, Russia has really been utilizing these Iranian-made drones. President Zelensky, in one of his recent addresses, said that this is proof that the Russian military is essentially bankrupt. But according to the Institute for the Study of War, what is your assessment as to the strength of the Russian military, both in its ability to supply higher and more sophisticated weapons?
So that's an interesting question, because we've assessed that the use of these Iranian-made drones is more reflective of the fact that Russia's missile arsenal has been very substantially degraded over the course of the war. They've been using higher precision systems against low value, not necessarily military targets, to the point where they've had to almost reorient their understanding and use of different weapon systems, which is how the Iranian drones have entered the equation. And we've seen over the past few weeks, especially, that these drones aren't being used in a way that's necessarily generating asymmetric effects. in that they're being used very purposely as a way to generate psychological terror effects with strikes on residential infrastructure, civilian infrastructure, etc., as we saw in Kiev earlier this week. But they're not necessarily being used to generate battlefield effects by striking what would be considered legitimate military targets. And this, in general, is reflective of both Russia's weapon capabilities and kind of the way that they're misprioritizing the psychological effects on civilians as opposed to striking legitimate military targets.
You mentioned the potential psychological effects of these weapons, video released from police body cam footage as well as other user-generated content shows, or at least you hear these drones coming in, and some people have made it sound like they're akin to old-fashioned mopeds with their whining motors. But I wanted to ask you about the efficacy of these weapons, because in the past, Russia has used very sophisticated weapons to hit legitimate military targets. But as you said, you know, they're using these drones perhaps in a less effective way. But what is the efficacy and potential for causing harm to Ukrainian targets by these drones?
So we've seen over the last week strikes on Ukrainian energy infrastructure. And this is an example of the way that Russia could be targeting effective infrastructure. But considering that they're continuing to try to generate psychological effects and continuing to target civilian infrastructure in a way that's more psychological than military, we're seeing this continued misprioritization in a way. Zelensky's statement about 30% of energy infrastructure having been damaged this week is kind of a good example of the way that Russian forces could be targeting energy and more effective infrastructure, but they're choosing not to and to continue to kind of wreak havoc on civilian areas.
And one last question. I want to turn the attention to Kherson, which is the only regional capital that Russia has controlled since it began its full-scale invasion of Ukraine back in February. Russian-installed officials there have begun the process of evacuating, in their words, civilians to the Russian Federation. What does the ISW make of this development, and what potential impacts could this have on the war moving forward?
So the evacuation orders are dual purpose, two sides of the same coin. On one side, we have the fact that this is likely an effort to evacuate Russian collaborators and occupation officials from occupied areas in Kherson Oblast, which is reflective of this growing and pervasive fear on the Russian side of Ukrainian counteroffensive actions in Kherson Oblast, counteroffensive successes, and the slow, steady push that Ukrainians seem to be making towards the center, the heart of the Russian occupation of Kherson. So that's one side, is kind of addressing the Russian fear as well as trying to evacuate their occupation organs. The second part of this is part of a likely more deliberate campaign to forcibly deport and relocate Ukrainian civilians as part of more of an extended ethnic cleansing type of campaign. The forced deportation and deliberate deportation of Ukrainian civilians, including children, into the Russian Federation fits the standard of ethnic cleansing. And we've seen this over the last few weeks and months, in fact, of the Russian occupation officials using the guise of the rest and rehabilitation of Ukrainian civilians to massively remove them to Russia. So we have two sides of the same coin that are both reflective of a fear of Ukrainian advances and a desire to carry out this extended ethnic cleansing campaign.
Carolina Hurd is a Russia researcher at the Institute for the Study of War, a think tank here in the United States. Carolina, thank you very much for your time.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Steve.
For additional updates on the war throughout the day, be sure to visit voanews.com/flashpoint. You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Miller. VOA Russian service reporter Yulia Savchenko spoke with Rose Gottmuller from Stanford University via Skype. She's also a former Deputy Secretary General of NATO, as well as Under Secretary of State for Arms Control and International Security at the U.S. State Department. Savchenko began the conversation by asking Gottmuller to explain why dialogue between Moscow and Washington is important, even though tensions are frayed.
Even during the very darkest days of the Cold War, when we had deep, deep disagreements over the Vietnam War and over the politics and the fighting in the Middle East, we were able to negotiate to reduce and eliminate nuclear weapons and to put in place the major regimes that are at the heart of our efforts to prevent nuclear proliferation. I always say that Soviet diplomats were giants of the non-proliferation treaty regime negotiations. So in the late 1960s into the early 1970s, we were able to negotiate and put in place some really important treaties and agreements that limit and control nuclear weapons. So my answer is yes, even in the midst of crisis, we must be able to negotiate because these weapons are existential threats. They could kill not only Russians and Americans, but people around the globe. So we need to negotiate and control them.
Rose, you argued in your testimony on the Hill that it is in the national interest of the United States to have such mechanisms in place. And I was just wondering, is there a same level of interest in Moscow, and are the stakes equally high?
Both countries have an interest in predictability, and that is what my testimony before the Senate Armed Services Committee was all about. The United States is now entering into a modernization of its nuclear arsenal that is needed. I want to stress this is a modernization, not a buildup, because both countries are under the limits of the New START treaty. We can deploy 700 missiles and bombers. Same on the Russian side. We can deploy 1,550 warheads to go on those missiles and bombers, same on the Russian side. So there is predictability for both countries. We understand that we are not building up. We are not arms racing with nuclear weapons. And that is very, very important. But the United States needs predictability while it modernizes its forces. The Russian Federation has already just about completed its own nuclear modernization. And so at this moment, I think it's important for the United States to be able to modernize, but not to be concerned about a buildup of Russian nuclear weapons.
Rose, I guess it's a philosophical question, but when we're talking about non-proliferation and modernization of nuclear forces at the same time, is there some kind of a contradiction there?
There's no contradiction, Yulia, as I see it, as long as limits remain in place under strategic arms reduction treaties. It's what I call a judicious modernization. It is replacing what we already have. Some of these weapons are, you know, from the 1970s or the 1980s. Again, it was the same on the Russian side. They were deploying systems that had been built in the USSR in the 1970s and 1980s. They become dangerous. They become unsafe to operate. They simply become ineffective. And so that's the heart of deterrence, right? That nuclear weapons should never be thought about as weapons that we would use in war. But we need to be confident in their effectiveness if the terrible day ever arrives when they do need to be used. That is the heart of nuclear deterrence, confidence in their effectiveness. So that is the main, I think, point here, that modernization can and should occur for a number of reasons, but it should be kept under limits, and we should continue to look for ways to reduce and eliminate nuclear weapons.
When we're talking about arms control these days, it's assumed that it is strategic weapons that need to be covered by the treaties. What about the tactical nukes? Because they're at the center of the discussions and actually the standoff right now.
You know that it's not so much a matter of strategic or non-strategic where the warheads per se are concerned. We call them non-strategic or tactical nuclear warheads, but it's actually their delivery vehicles and the shorter range of their delivery vehicles that determines their status as non-strategic nuclear warheads. So I think that the United States' idea is to place limits on all nuclear warheads, deployed and non-deployed, strategic and non-strategic. And that, I think, helps to lay on the table a potential for compromise, because the Russian Federation has long been concerned about the ability of the United States to upload more warheads on its strategic long-range intercontinental delivery vehicles, while the United States has been concerned about Russian non-strategic capabilities, shorter-range missiles, shorter-range weapon systems that it would also load non-strategic or tactical warheads on. It's a bit confusing, but the basic point is that I can see some trade space there when talking about a limit on all warheads, deployed and non-deployed, strategic and non-strategic.
That's former Deputy Secretary General of NATO, as well as Undersecretary of State for Arms Control and International Security at the U.S. State Department, Rose Guttmuller, who is currently at Stanford University. She was speaking with my VOA Russian colleague, Yulia Savchenko. Not only governments, but also individuals as well as organizations are sending money and supplies to Ukraine. Increasingly, cryptocurrency is part of the pipeline of monetary aid. Anna Rice narrates this story to round us out.
Sergei Vasilchuk, the CEO of a large cryptocurrency blockchain company called Everstake, was in Miami, Florida, when Russia invaded Ukraine, his homeland.
Co-founder of Solana Foundation, Anatoly Yakovenko, also originally from Ukraine, from Odessa, called me and asked what I was going to do. It felt like a cold shower. I realized that I was doing nothing. So I asked myself, what could I do?
Five of Vasilchuk's employees were on the front lines, and he quickly realized that getting monetary aid to the Ukrainian system quickly was something he could help with.
A blockchain transaction takes several seconds, which is very different than a wire transfer or something over the SWIFT network.
Austin Federa works at the Solana Foundation, which deals with the development and safe use of Solana, a form of cryptocurrency. His organization joined the Aid for Ukraine Cryptocurrency Fund, and so did Ukraine's Ministry of Digital Transformation. That centralized the fundraising efforts and allowed better oversight over how the money was being distributed. Long-awaited
merged. They were basically able to set up a system where there were five individuals who all had authority over these funds that would come in. Three out of five had to agree on how those funds were going to be used, and then they could be distributed through there.
Vasilchuk recalls the first few donations coming from wealthy donors, each a few million dollars worth. This first step showed the cryptocurrency community the project was reliable, and more donations followed.
People from the US, many from Russia made donations, the ones against the war. They simply didn't have any other way to donate. Thousands of transactions.
By mid-October, Aid for Ukraine had donated over $57 million in crypto to the war effort. The flow of money has dissipated in part because the government of Ukraine launched the country's official fundraising platform called United 24 in May. That group has collected over 200 million in donations, some of that in cryptocurrency. But no matter where it's coming from, Vasilchuk and his partners believe cryptocurrency is ideal for emergency situations, when a country needs money and needs it fast.
Whether you're sending 10 cents or $10 million on a blockchain, it's just as simple and it's just as quick.
And getting money quickly can translate into saved lives and an uninterrupted supply of resources for Ukrainian fighters. For Irina Salomka in New York, Anna Rice, VOA News.
And that's going to do it for us today. Be sure to stay up to date with the latest coverage of Ukraine, as well as news and events from around the world. You can do so 24 hours a day by pointing your web browser on your phone, your tablet, your desktop computer, or any other electronic device to voanews.com. And for even more pictures, videos, and stories, be sure to follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform. On behalf of the entire team at Flashpoint Ukraine, thank you for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Steve Miller. Be well, be safe, and good night.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.